Hey everyone, and welcome to the Bitcoin Way podcast. I'm your host, Michael Jordan. I appreciate you being here. Just wrapped up a fantastic conversation with Vijay Boyapati. He is author of The Bullish Case for Bitcoin. An awesome guy. Great conversation. If you are newer to Bitcoin or you've got people in your life that you want to share Bitcoin with, I think this is a fantastic conversation to watch or send along to others. We just cover pretty much everything, you know, why the bullish case for Bitcoin, some of the misconceptions that people have, some of Vijay's predictions for the next 12 to 18 months. It was a very fun conversation, an honor to get to speak to someone of his caliber, and I hope you enjoy my conversation with him as much as I did. Hey everyone, and welcome to the Bitcoin Way podcast. Like I said in the intro, I've got Vijay here. Vijay, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Michael. It's great to talk to you.
I appreciate it. Hey, let's start with your background because this is something I actually don't know much about. I'm curious how you look at Bitcoin. Is it from a technical perspective, finance? Tell me just a little bit about before Bitcoin and as you got into Bitcoin, sort of the experience you've had.
Yeah, so my brief history is I came to the United States to do a PhD in computer science. So my background is in computer science. I didn't start the PhD and ended up getting a job at Google. Worked at Google from 2002 to 2007. And while I was at Google, I met a bunch of libertarians and got interested in Austrian economics and really did a deep dive while I was at Google on Austrian economics. Then I left Google to campaign for Ron Paul in the 2008 election, and I was just super excited. He was talking about things that no one else had been talking about, like why America should not be involved in the war in Iraq, but also talking about sound money, the importance of sound money, and why it was so harmful to have a central bank that created more and more money. Unfortunately, he did not become the nominee for the Republican Party, and I became quite dejected in political activism and realized from my up close experience of political activism that there are much more powerful interests which determine the course of political events, and grassroots politics doesn't actually make much difference, which was pretty disappointing for me. So it was a few years of feeling disappointed about that and like the political future of the United States. And then in 2011, I came across Bitcoin because a friend of mine and I, we had a bet with each other about Federal Reserve policy. This is kind of the nerdy thing you do is bet on Federal Reserve policy and whether or not they're going to increase interest rates. And the bet was for a single silver coin, which at the time was worth $50. And I won the bet. And my friend said, hey, I don't want to give you the silver coin. I want to give you this other form of money. It's called Bitcoin. You should check it out. It's way better than silver. And my friend is an incredible investor, best investor I know. And I said, okay, sure, I'll take this Bitcoin, whatever it is. And he was like, you have to download some software. And I'm like, huh? And so I had my little dinky laptop and I downloaded the Bitcoin core software. And then my laptop started buzzing, started getting really hot. I'm like, what the hell is happening? I was downloading the blockchain and verifying the transactions. It took a few hours. And then my friend was like, okay, now let's create an address. And he showed me what an address was. I had no idea what he was talking about. And then he said, I'm going to send you 5 Bitcoins. They were about $10 at the time. So the equivalent of one silver coin, $50. And he sent it to me and then he said, look, I sent it to you. And he showed me a block explorer, which at the time was unintelligible. It's just a string of numbers and letters. And again, I was just like, what the hell is this? So that's how I got my first 5 Bitcoins. And that story ends a little sadly because I gave that laptop to one of my ex-girlfriends. And in 2017, when Bitcoin started going up a lot, I realized, wow, that laptop is worth like $10,000 now. It's worth $50,000. It's worth $100,000. I need to get that laptop back. And I emailed her and I said, do you have the laptop? Can I get it back? And she said she had lost it, which she had. She lost it in a hotel. And you can verify that because the Bitcoins have never moved on the blockchain. They're dead. essentially. So I've made a donation to all other Bitcoin holders of 5 Bitcoins, my first 5 Bitcoins, are never coming back.
That's so. Since that, like, would you have hodled those 5 if you'd gotten them back? Like, had you bought into the premise of Bitcoin at that point, or were you just hoping you could get your 100K worth of Bitcoin or, you know, whatever back?
I think by 2017, I certainly felt like I had a good understanding of what Bitcoin was, and I was a good hodler. I think very early on, I realized Bitcoin was a monetary phenomena. And it was a new form of money. At first, I was just confused what it was. But after some reflection, thinking about it, I was like, this is a new form of money. And because of my background in Austrian economics, I became super interested. The silly thing is I should have just bought a bunch of it. But I was much more interested in it from an economic perspective. I was like, what is this thing? Like, how does it have value? How does it have any value at all? And I sort of went down a rabbit hole and really started thinking about it. And I had thought a lot about this question in regards to gold, because the same question applies to gold. Gold is a useless rock. It's not useful for anything. I mean, people nowadays say, oh, gold is valuable because you can use it in, you know, your teeth as a filling, a dental filling, or maybe it's valuable because of jewelry, or we use it in electronic circuits. All of those are completely incorrect answers to why gold has value. And I had thought about this. Why does gold have value? It has value because it's good for a purpose, and that's being money. And humans need money. Without money, we don't have a division of labor, and we don't have civilization. We live in a very primitive state of barter. So I'd thought about that, and that helped me think about Bitcoin. And I started to realize, wow, this is better than gold. This is like gold with teleportation built in. And as I started to realize that, I started to get excited about Bitcoin. And I think I would say I had figured it out by about 2014. I had a good thesis for why Bitcoin was valuable and why I thought the value was going up. And it took a few years, but I started writing my article on the bullish case for Bitcoin in 2017. Based on the ideas that I think I mostly had solidified in my head in 2014.
Got it. So I want to get to your article and the book in just a minute. I do want to take a step back, though. I didn't know about your experience with Ron Paul or campaigning, working on his campaign. I'm curious because a lot of Bitcoiners would commend you for that and would love to have a reincarnation of Ron Paul on the ballot. Many are excited about RFK Jr. I'm curious, my sense with him, my struggle with him is his, from a policy perspective, he still seems very big government. He doesn't feel like a libertarian alternative necessarily, but he sort of, what you said about Ron Paul was he talks about issues that no one else is talking about. Does that excite you in any way, or do you see any parallel? And to the extent you even want to talk any politics, I'm just kind of curious how you're thinking about, you know, the way this might play out, or what level of enthusiasm you have, you know, in this election.
Yeah, I've always been fascinated in politics. So happy to talk about it. I have the same view as you, Michael, that I think RFK is an independent thinker. It's always refreshing to see someone who's not just a politician and using sort of boilerplate statements that sound good and will get votes. I think he's saying what he believes. My problem, though, is that while he's good on certain positions that are important to me, like he certainly against the war in Ukraine, he was against the COVID lockdowns, and he's talking about issues I think actually important that no one else is talking about, kind of in the same sense that Ron Paul was, like the importance of eating good food, of being outside and being healthy, and how we the health of our country is being destroyed by this kind of food industrial complex. That's something that's really important to me as a father of 4 kids. It's you're constantly being tempted with all these foods which are really bad for you and made with just industrial junk, like seed oils and high fructose corn syrup and things like that. So I'm glad that he's talking about that. But again, like you said, he doesn't see the government as the problem. He thinks, okay, we can fix the government and then things will be better. My view is fundamentally the government is the problem, and that society would be better off if people had more freedom. And more freedom means freedom is inversely proportional to the size of government. The bigger government is, the less freedom you have. So we would all be better off if government shrank as much as possible. And I don't think he sees it that way, unfortunately. I admire him for a lot of things, but sort of on that base principle, I don't think we would agree.
Yeah. I know it's antithetical to the sort of the Bitcoin ethos, but to the extent that I would trust someone in that position to do what they felt was right, I think he's the guy. I just have a really hard time with some of the specific policies, even though he's talking about all these things that are important, both to me personally, I think to many Bitcoiners, and especially as a father as well. But I'm having a hard time getting over that hurdle of, I just disagree on so much policy that I just, you know, I'm kind of unclear what to do. So I'll be scratching my head on this till November, I suppose.
I know you're interviewing me, Mike, but this is a random question that I have for you in the middle of this interview. Sure. We both have block clocks, and I'm looking at yours, and you sound American to me, but it looks like yours is on the euro, is it? Or on the pound?
It flips back and forth. Pound, euro, and dollar.
Oh, very cool. I haven't seen that setting yet. I should do that too. It surprised me. I was like, what, the price is 62,000? What happened? Oh, it's in pounds or euros or something.
Buy the dip, VJ, hop off and buy the dip. All right. Hey, let's talk about some of your writing. So you authored an article, The Bullish Case for Bitcoin, that became a book. I'm curious, what was the inspiration? Was it like a gap in the educational market of Bitcoin? Was it something, were you kind of writing it to a person or group of people in your life that, you know, and then you felt like it could go, you know, to a broader audience? What was the impetus for that?
Yeah, I think it was, it's hard for people now to kind of understand what it was like back in 2016, 2017. There weren't many good educational resources out there. And I think beyond that, there was a lot of misconceptions about what Bitcoin was and why it's valuable. And there was, you know, a huge schism in the community as well about whether what should Bitcoin be? Should it be a payment system, or is it actually closer to digital gold? And I had a very strong opinion on this, and I didn't think it had been well argued. But beyond that, I wanted to write an article that I could give to friends and family who had started asking me about Bitcoin, and they knew I was crazy about it. And they would ask me about it and say, well, what is this Bitcoin thing? Why are you interested in it? And I wanted to be able to give them a resource and say, well, this is why I think it's interesting and valuable. So when I first started writing it, I had only expected that it would be read by friends and family, and I was hoping if I got lucky, a few people on Wall Street might check it out, and that would be like a huge success for me. It ended up getting read over a million times, and it was translated into over 20 languages by volunteers all around the world, and completely blew me away. It touched a nerve, I think, and the reason that happened was that people just searching for an explanation for Bitcoin. People out there like, what is this thing? Mm-hmm. And I think it provided that, that basic explanation for why this crazy new invention had value. Because I think, in my mind, that's the most important question in economics today. This is something that no economist predicted could happen, and most of them in the early days were very skeptical could survive or would exist for any period of time. And so it really called for an explanation, an economic explanation, which is what I tried to provide. Why does this have value? Why is its value increasing over time? And I wanted to provide an economic framework for people to think about that.
Yeah. So one of the things you hit on is like, what is this thing? What's the use? Is it a payment system? One of the things you talk about is, you know, a lot of people are, I mean, one of the common questions is, well, I can't buy my coffee with it. So what's the point? Or people themselves are trying to figure out what it is. You talk about how it's lack of medium exchange use case today is you're putting the cart before the horse effectively, right? It needs to serve as a store of value first, and then a medium of exchange comes later. Can you elaborate on, like, talk about why that is and sort of how this works historically?
Yeah, that was the common criticism of Bitcoin in the early days. Like, no one's using it to buy anything, so why is it valuable? And I mentioned in my book, I think one of the biggest misconceptions created by modern monetary economics is the idea that money is defined as a medium of exchange. That actually completely ignores the other functions of money, which are, I think, even more important than the medium of exchange function of money. So what I wanted to explain is that money goes through an evolution. Money does not become a medium of exchange immediately. And you can look to the example of gold. Gold was money for most of human history, most of civilized human history. We don't know what people were using prior to civilization. But gold wasn't used for coffee payments when the first humans sort of dug it out of the ground and thought, wow, this is a cool, shiny thing. I want to keep it. They weren't going to the coffee store saying, I want to pay for a coffee. And so what I explain is that gold went through this evolution too. It just took a lot longer. And the first stage of the evolution is that people hold these things as money just as a curiosity, as a whimsy, or something that's cool. It's shiny rock. It's cool in a lot of ways. It doesn't rust. It seems to last over a long period of time. So I just want to keep it because it's cool. And when enough people see that other people are doing that, it starts to transition to being a store of value because you realize other people value it and are willing to hold on to it over time. And so you think, maybe I should hold some of it as well. So you try and get some. Eventually, when enough people hold it, it becomes suitable as a medium of exchange because it's valued by enough people in a population that people will accept it in exchange. They will say, yeah, I do value gold, and if you want to pay me in gold, I'm happy to take it. Bitcoin is still at that early stage of transitioning from what's essentially a digital collectible that was in the early days. People held it even before it had a market price. And why would you hold it if you're one of the first people who came across Bitcoin when you can't do it? It doesn't have any value at all. You can't sell it for dollars. You can't buy anything with it. It's because it was a digital curiosity. It's like, wow, this is cool. It's a new thing that's been created. Then eventually it got a market price, a very low market price. And people started paying for it and saying, I want to hold some. I'm willing to buy it. And they were holding it sort of as a nascent store of value. Now there are a lot of people around the world who hold Bitcoin, but it's still not at the stage where it's held by enough people that it's suitable as a medium of exchange. Because if you're a merchant, if you're a baker, say, a tiny fraction of the people who come into your bakery hold Bitcoin in savings. So there's really no incentive to create the means by which they can pay you in Bitcoin because you have to figure out the payment system. You have to understand Bitcoin. You have to understand wallets. Like, why bother? Like, none of your customers are going to use it. But that will change. If you're a bakery and say 50% or 75% of your customers own Bitcoin, there's a huge incentive to offer payment in Bitcoin because people have Bitcoin and they may be willing to spend it. So that transition will come in time. It was just the big misconception. People thought, oh, money is a medium of exchange rather than money is one of the functions. Sorry, medium of exchange is one of the functions of money, and it takes time for money to evolve to have that function.
So how do you think that plays out in sort of as adoption grows? Because right now, my impression is we're at, what, maybe 1% global adoption or something like that.
Yeah.
And there's sort of a chicken and egg problem. Not a pure problem because there are businesses that accept, Lightning payments and things like that. So there's a way for the supply to sort of disperse itself without people selling, folks like myself, I'm never selling. Eventually I'll buy something with it when I find something worth exchanging in Bitcoin. How do you sort of anticipate, though, that playing out? Is it just a matter of we're going to be on a bit of a slow road to businesses accepting Bitcoin paying their employees in Bitcoin, or is there some other mechanism that I'm not thinking about that can lead us to global adoption and get us from the store of value point in time to a broader medium of exchange use case? Or does it even matter at the end of the day if the medium of exchange use case plays out? Maybe that's my first question, and then you can answer the first.
Yeah, well, I don't think there's any shortcut. I think it needs to become established as a store of value, and I think we're still far off from that. Mm-hmm. I think that process honestly could take decades. Maybe it happens faster than I expect, but it could take decades. To answer your second question, it's certainly possible that Bitcoin could become a global store of value without becoming a medium of exchange. And an analogy you can look at is gold. Gold is a global store of value. It's valued all across the world. If you have a gold coin, you can be pretty much anywhere on earth and you'll be able to sell that gold coin. It's liquid. You might have to sell it at a slight discount to the spot price, but you'll get someone who will want to buy it. But gold isn't used to buy coffee. Gold isn't used to buy anything. No merchants accept gold. So it's certainly possible that Bitcoin finds a similar role in the global financial system. It becomes a non-sovereign store of value, that is a store of value that's not connected to any government, that people want because they see it as valuable, they see it as liquid, they see it as a mechanism for being able to take their wealth anywhere they want. So even if you can't use it to buy coffee, there's huge value if you're in, say, China and you want to escape and you feel like your government's oppressive. You put your savings into Bitcoin, you cross a border, and you're able to take your savings with you. This is a big deal. If you think about World War II and how the Jews had to flee the Nazis across Europe, I like to think of the example of the Austrian economist Ludwig von Mises. He escaped just ahead of the Nazis. He escaped from Switzerland and made it to the United States, but he lost all of his assets. So he entered the United States impoverished, and he was a well-regarded professor of economics in Europe, ends up in the US as a nobody with no money, and has to compromise on this kind of crappy job at New York University, not a real professorship. And he couldn't afford to wait because he had no money. Now imagine if he had something like Bitcoin. Put all your savings in Bitcoin, then just get out of here and you have a new life. So even if you don't have that medium of exchange roll money and merchants aren't adopting it, there is massive value to people and their freedom to move, their freedom to take their savings and the fruits of their labor across borders. That's one of the things I'm most excited about Bitcoin for, because I think it increases the average level of freedom across the world.
So I have a friend who's a wealth advisor and has really struggled to figure out Bitcoin. And my sense is it's just this sort of Keynesian worldview that many have. It's like 60-40 portfolio, some inflation's good, just like the classic stuff you hear. And my sense is that what you just said wouldn't resonate with him because he doesn't understand gold. Like, it's almost like you need to get there first to understand like historical money, and which is probably why you started there in your book, is where are the origins of money. But what do you think that delta is? Like, how do you get someone like that to cross that chasm from 60-40 portfolio inflation? Some inflation's good if we just figure out the right amount, to, I understand why this yellow rock retains value. And then they can make the leap to Bitcoin. It's like you have to get there before you can ever even conceive of Bitcoin's value.
Yeah, I think the problem here is that most people take for granted the system that we have today and assume that this is basically how things have worked and it just makes sense. They never look into it. They never question it. They don't think about Bretton Woods and where did this monetary system all come from. So it does take a little bit of a historical dive to first understand, like, why does money have value? If you can get a person interested in that question, then I think they're on the path to getting Bitcoin. And that's a tough question, right? Money is valued in such a different way to the way that TradFi people think about everything else. Mm-hmm. All other assets, if you have a TradFi mindset, are valued based on cash flow. Real estate, rent, bonds, interest, stocks, dividends. You can value something like a house in a fairly logical way by looking at its cash flow through rent and saying, you know, it earns $5,000 a month and put a multiple of 10 on that or whatever multiple you want. And that gets you to the value of the house. That people understand that. That makes sense. Money doesn't work like that. Like, gold doesn't produce any interest. Bitcoin does not produce any interest. A dollar bill does not produce any interest. So why does it have purchasing power? Why does it have value? Then you have to get people to explore why do we have money at all? Like, what would the world look like if we didn't have money? It would be terrible. We would all be, you know, dirt poor and living in adobe huts. So once you can get a person curious about that, why does money have value? Then I think they're ready to jump to Bitcoin and understand why Bitcoin has value, because they will start to understand that Bitcoin itself is just another form of money. It's just a better form of money.
Right. Yeah. I think that's a good way of framing it. You have to understand the role that money plays. And when you understand the importance of that, then you can begin to evaluate what criteria, what should we be looking for in money? What's good money? And you very quickly would then disqualify anything fiat. Gold for the longest time made sense because it was the best option, but it has shortcomings. It's confiscatable, hard to secure and you know, move long distances. Hard to transport. Exactly. And so I think that's an interesting way of starting. One of the things I've really come to appreciate is the reality of recency bias that people have, because before Bitcoin, I never thought historically about, well, you know, like you hear that there's nothing new under the sun and history repeats itself, or at least rhymes, or, you know, those sorts of things. But you tend to assume like, oh, the Roman Empire, that was this thing in the past, we're different or more civilized or, you know, or whatever. And the reality is we're making the same sorts of mistakes over and over. And just because something's been for 50 years doesn't mean it will continue indefinitely into the future. So I like that. I like that way of framing it. But I think maybe the bigger struggle than getting them to understand money is getting them to understand that history matters. And evaluating the origins of money is a critical part of understanding what would be optimal today, if that makes sense.
I think most people don't feel ready as well because they seem to think the monetary system works. And I think a lot more people woke up to the fact that it might not work or it might break in the future from the inflation that happened in the last few years. Once you've had an experience personally of something, like why is the price of food 30% higher than it was a few years ago? I think that woke a lot of people up to the fact that the US dollar is something that can lose value quickly. That doesn't mean all of them connect the dots and say, well, maybe I should be looking at other forms of money. But I do think it opens a channel for which you can begin a conversation with a person and say, well, you know, your money dropped in value, the money you had in the bank dropped in value. Why do you think that is? Why do you think the value of the money dropped? And it's hard to get people to go down a rabbit hole because people are living their lives, right? They have other concerns, they have families, they have their jobs, and this is kind of a random esoteric thing. But when it hits a person's pocketbook, then I find they're generally more receptive to hearing about this stuff.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. Hey, just a quick break and we'll get back to the show. But I want to introduce you to our very first sponsor of the Bitcoin Way podcast, Satoshi Coffee Company. Satoshi Coffee, sats.coffee is the URL. They make high quality, fresh roasted coffee, and they even put the block number to show proof of work on each bag. If you're watching on YouTube, you can see that. I'm not a coffee snob, but I'm sort of picky about what I do enjoy. And this Satoshi blend, which is one of their more popular blends, is incredible. They also have a blend from El Salvador and a couple of others. I'd highly recommend you trying out all of them. But the cool thing about Satoshi Coffee Company is they are Bitcoin only and only accept Bitcoin as payment. And as a Bitcoin Way podcast listener, you get 6.9% off if you go to sats.coffee and enter code TBW69. Again, Satoshi Coffee Company, sats.coffee. Check them out. Support Bitcoin only companies like Satoshi Coffee Company. The other factor I think at play is what anyone in traditional finance almost by definition has or works with people who own assets, And so they have something to appreciate in value with inflation. 50% of people, though, don't fit that bill, right? And so there are, you know, like my friend who's a wealth advisor, just as an example, the people who he works with are up, you know, probably upper middle class, maybe, you know, lower upper class sort of folks who are probably worked very hard in their lives. This is no knock on them, but are in a fortunate position today compared with someone living in, you know, sort of the lower 20%, you know, of America. They're in a position where if their grocery bill increases by 30%, I mean, they're out of luck. You know, I mean, at some point you can't make ends meet. And it seems like that desperate minority is beginning to amount to something of a majority, you know, yeah. over time. Yeah. And I think that's where the breaking point is, and people have to then reevaluate. The question is, how will we funnel people into this solution of Bitcoin? Because I think most people are like, I'm suffering, what's wrong? And they have no idea that there is optionality here.
Yeah, so. I think part of it is people have to become receptive on their own. And some of it is educational outreach. And that's, you know, with my article, I wanted to provide a resource. There are so many amazing, talented people doing that now. So I feel really excited about that. The resources are now available. If anyone wants to learn about Bitcoin, like your podcast, this is an example of the people who follow you and your community have the opportunity to learn about Bitcoin because they trust you and they'll listen to you. So you're providing a resource to a group of people. There's so many people doing this now that I feel pretty confident that once people have the inclination, they'll have the resources as well.
Yeah, I think you're right. The question is, for many, I think the level of curiosity and willingness to engage. So I'm hopeful we can just bring part of the reason I wanted to have you on is I think you articulate some of these use cases, some of the like this path that we have to take very well. And there's a lot of great content out there, but a lot of it begins with like a presumption of some knowledge of Bitcoin or something like that. And I think a lot of times we just need to start the basics. So another thing you talk about, and I think this is something that more upsets the traditional finance community, and that is they view Bitcoin as something of a religion. And you talk about this in your book. You've got a quote. It's, while the comparison to religion may give Bitcoin an aura of irrational faith, it is entirely rational for the individual owner to evangelize for a superior monetary good and for a society to standardize on it. So my question to you is, what is it about this religious aspect of Bitcoin that you think draws criticism from the traditional finance folks? Is any of that criticism warranted? And how would you respond to that, I guess, more broadly?
Yeah, I think that quote sums it up pretty well. It's the idea that, oh, these people aren't investing based on reason. They're doing it based on faith. Mm-hmm. And it's obviously based on faith and irrational because this thing isn't worth anything. It doesn't have any cash flows and no one's using it to buy anything. So it clearly can't be worth anything. This is just a religion. What they haven't understood is that it's a better form of money along the attributes that make for a good money. And I talk about that in my book, things like portability, scarcity, divisibility, along all the attributes that we have known for a very long time make for good money, Bitcoin excels. That's why it's outcompeting the other forms of money at the margin. But once you become a Bitcoiner, of course you have a reason to evangelize it because you have understood and recognized this and you want your friends and family to recognize it too. Hey, by the way, if you see that Bitcoin has these properties that I've recognized, then you will get the upside too. And I want you to get the upside because I care about you. Plus, the fact that more people are adopting it as money means the value will go up and that benefits me too. And it sounds to some people when they hear this like this is a bubble or like a pyramid scheme or something. And actually, I say that in my book, all money is a bubble. All forms of money are a bubble. That is, their value is much higher than their underlying use value. Like the value of gold is, you know, $15 trillion. But you can't really use gold for anything. It's just that it's good money. and historically people recognized it as good money. And there were things that were used as money in human history which really had no value, like shells and beads and things like that. So money is a bubble that never has to burst. Money is this very interesting thing that it does look like a bubble, and I acknowledge that in my book, but it's a bubble that has value because it provides utility through our ability to use it for savings and exchange. So what we want in this bubble that is money is something that functions really well as money. It has really good attributes. Now, gold was preferred as money over sand because it had the attribute of scarcity. Sand is not good money because you go down to the beach, you get a bucket, and you'd be rich. And so people wouldn't be able to keep their savings over time. The money would be inflated away very quickly. So it just happened that value accrued to gold because it had that property of scarcity. And if you look at the property of scarcity with Bitcoin, it's the scarcest asset that's ever existed in human history. And that's why it has a huge advantage. And that's why people want it, because they realize if I get some of this, no one will ever be able to inflate it away. And that's a very attractive thing to hold as an asset.
Yeah. So you spend a good deal of time in your book addressing common misconceptions about Bitcoin. I think you're very intellectually honest in the way that you approach it, in that you more or less steel man many of the arguments and draw attention to where there are credible reasons to have questions. Are there any of those that you find most compelling? Like, I guess, is an argument against Bitcoin? And if so, how would you share an explanation with friends and family, and how would you frame some of those misconceptions?
I still believe the biggest threat to Bitcoin is a nation state attack or a coordinated nation state attack. I don't think Bitcoin has great enough adoption yet that it's invulnerable to this. Mm-hmm. And if nation states got together and said, we have to ban this and kill this thing, I still think they have enough power to do that. And they could go to, they could go to various centralized points in Bitcoin and really do massive damage. They could go to all the exchanges and say, we're shutting you all down. They could go to all the ETFs and say, we're confiscating all your Bitcoin. They could go to all the mining facilities and blow them up, for instance. Mm-hmm. I mean, that there is the potential for significant damage to be done to Bitcoin. What we need is Bitcoin to get enough global adoption that it becomes politically infeasible for that to happen. And we're on the path to that, definitely. In the United States, we have more adoption than globally. And you see a lot of politicians who now own Bitcoin or are advocates for Bitcoin. And at some point, there'll be enough adoption in Bitcoin that it's as difficult to ban as it would be to ban a 401k, the 401k program, because so many people have their savings in 401ks that if the government said, look, we're running these deficits and so we need more capital, we're going to confiscate everyone's 401k, there would be a revolution. There'd be riots in the streets and people would say, no, you can't do that. We're on the path to that with Bitcoin. And I think maybe this cycle or next cycle, we will be there where there's enough adoption of people holding Bitcoin. It's just too difficult, at least in a democratic country like the United States, to ban Bitcoin. And then once there's enough countries like that, I think it's globally untouchable. Some countries may ban it and make it very painful to own Bitcoin, but there'll be enough countries where if you live in, say, North Korea or Iran, you can escape and use Bitcoin elsewhere. So Bitcoin won't die after that. But I think it's an open question. And the reason why governments, even democratic governments, would be hostile to Bitcoin is if enough savings flow into Bitcoin, it makes it much harder to control monetary policy. Monetary policy and the ability to inflate the money supply only works if people have their savings in that money, in dollars, for instance. So if everyone's savings fled into Bitcoin, the Federal Reserve wouldn't have control over monetary policy. They could try and increase interest rates, but it would just be completely ineffective. And I think they have an inkling of this. I think there was an article in the Wall Street Journal that I quoted in my book where they say the big risk of Bitcoin is not that it crashes, it's that it goes up and it keeps going up, because that would really hurt monetary policy. So they have an inkling of this, but they haven't acted on it. And my concern is that at some point, let's say this cycle Bitcoin goes up by 5x, it's starting to get to the same size as gold. And gold has always been something that central banks have looked at as a warning sign that their policy might get out of control, or they're losing control and that their currency is in danger. If gold starts going up in a currency, you know that currency is in trouble. I think Bitcoin is going to take the same role once it gets to a similar size to gold. And if Bitcoin gets to the same size as gold and then looks like it might 2x or 3x, that's when I think you're going to see panic. I think central banks will panic, and that's when I think you'll see the real nation state attack. But I'm hopeful that we can get to enough adoption by then, wide enough adoption across various countries, that this just will be politically infeasible. And the Federal Reserve saying something like we need to ban Bitcoin will cause riots in the street. And people will say, no, that's our savings, don't touch it. But yeah, I admit in the book, I think this is an open question.
Yeah, no, that's a fair one. Okay, so this is probably the most important question I'm going to ask you. And this is a sort of a personal thing. So I have a friend who works for one of the largest banks in the world. And he told me that, I haven't had a chance to like go into the details yet, but he said that they had a presentation that someone gave basically talking about what a scam, Bitcoin is like a generational scam. Right. So it's like an internal discussion. And so this guy, he doesn't understand Bitcoin. We've never really talked about it at length. And I'm thinking through like, okay, where do I start with him? And I'm curious. So when you're orange pilling someone, do you structure the entire conversation sort of like you have the book? Like, do you talk about the origins of money? Like if you're just sitting down one-on-one with a friend, or do you start with more like, hey, is your life getting cheaper or is it getting more expensive? And like kind of frame it in like real world terms that they understand today. Like, how do you think about that?
Yeah. So I have the book in my head, which is an advantage. And so I can, I can sort of spew it out pretty easily now. I've had many chances to practice this. But I think the important thing is you always got to meet people where they're at, not where you want them to be. And you have to understand where they're at. And some people, I've said this on Twitter, some people are not reachable yet. They're not in a place where they want to understand Bitcoin. And you have to judge that as well. Is this person ready to understand Bitcoin? It's not, at least in my experience, it's not that difficult to measure genuine curiosity. And when someone has genuine curiosity, I think they're ready. A lot of people are sort of stuck in their ways and they're like, there's nothing to, they're not ready really to think about Bitcoin. So you have to assess that. You have to, speak to your friend and see if they're the kind of person who's curious and ready to learn about Bitcoin. Then once you've assessed that, I think it's important to figure out where they're at. And maybe they're right at the beginning of their journey. They're in TradFi. They've never thought about money. Their world is dollars. You will need to go back, right to the beginning with them and start the conversation there. Or maybe they understand gold and maybe they do understand Bitcoin a little bit and their questions are a bit further along. Like, well, what about all these other cryptocurrencies? Aren't they better? You might need to meet them there. So it really depends on the person. You have to make that judgment for yourself. Yeah. I will say that the sort of space of people who are in that sort of semi-skeptical, but almost ready to learn, curious mindset, that's expanding, right? In the early days, in like 2010, 11, maybe that circle of people was like a couple thousand people. And over time, it was tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands. We're definitely at the point now with Bitcoin that there are probably tens of millions of people who know about Bitcoin. They've heard about it. And maybe they just need to hear about it a few more times. Friends and family keep bringing it up and eventually it clicks. And I've seen this a lot where people have heard about Bitcoin a number of times and eventually they get to the point where they contact me and they're like, can you tell me about Bitcoin? I'm curious now. And they've gotten to the point where they've just heard about it enough. And I call these touch points, the number of touch points a person needs before they're curious enough to look into something. And that's different for each person, All right. For me, I was lucky because I had two touch points. Two of my friends who I trust told me about Bitcoin and said, you need to look into this. And I, because of my trust in them, I did look into it. But some people, it might be 10 touch points. They might need to have everyone in their friend circle be talking about Bitcoin and talking about how they just bought Bitcoin to be like, oh, maybe I should think about it. So that concept of touch points is important as well. And planting the seed, you might not see any results when you speak to someone about Bitcoin, but that seed might, you know, blossom a few years down the line.
Right. And something, just a comment I'll add. I think one of the things that, you know, we tend to get proud of our toxicity as Bitcoiners. And, but I think there's, you know, and a lot of that happens online, and every Bitcoiner I've met in real life is just, you know, is great. I think ensuring that you're the type of person that people don't feel like it's not going to be an I told you so when they come back to learn more. It's not going to be, you know, like this, I don't know, just that they feel like you're approachable, that, hey, I ignored you once, but I'm coming back. I'm curious, that this is going to be a good, open, useful dialogue and not like a lecture that, you know, hey, if you'd gotten in at 15 instead of 70, like think about how much more you could buy, you know, or that sort of thing. So that's sort of an off comment, but something I think is really important in how we approach, especially loved ones, which should go without saying, but I don't think it always does.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think the vast majority of people should be treated that way and with good intent and the assumption of good faith that they are curious and they do want to learn. I will say that's my style. I try not to be toxic, but I would also say there is some place for the people who I think are toxic. I think some of them are actually trying to defend Bitcoin from people who are trying to attack Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. And I also think that there's some people out there who are just inveterate critics of Bitcoin. It doesn't matter, you know, what Bitcoin is or what they can learn. They're just like Peter Schiff is an example of this. He's had over a decade to understand Bitcoin and is clearly not interested in understanding Bitcoin. So I sympathize with the people who have toxicity towards people like that because they're so close-minded, so unwilling to learn that my strategy is not to be toxic to those people. My strategy is just to not engage with them at all. But I have sympathy for the ones who are like, no, that person their behavior deserves toxicity.
I agree with that. I will say, I think the better time to use that toxicity is less an attack, like a verbal attack of, well, like Peter Schiff, I don't like Bitcoin or it doesn't make sense. And more people who think that they're going to bring, you know, altcoin sort of features and attributes to Bitcoin, or they want to change the code, or they, you know, it's like, hey, we don't move fast and break things here. Like we move slow. I don't care how bad you want that. And it's like, to me, that's where like the toxicity is much appreciated. It's less my style. I'll banter a little bit with, you know, people, but yeah, I agree with you. I think when it comes to orange pilling your friends and family, I mean, the reason you wrote this book, I think it just requires a certain demeanor for most people, if you want to get through to them. So it's just something I think a lot of people need to keep in mind. I think I agree. There's a time and a place for toxicity. It's just probably not in your everyday conversations with someone who you're going to spend the holidays with. Yeah, maybe something to think about.
Yeah, you don't want to tell your mom to have fun staying poor.
Correct. That is not something you should ever utter to the person who brought you into this world. Okay. So, in your experience, what's the biggest sticking point for people learning about Bitcoin? We've sort of touched on a few of these things, but generally speaking, is it like a lack of understanding of the problem it solves? Is it something technical about the protocol or something else?
I think the first big thing is like not understanding why money has value. Mm. So people don't, once you've gotten over that, once you've thought about money a little bit and you recognize Bitcoin as money, then it becomes a little bit easier. I think people are like, the real issue I think with that I have, that I've seen the most frequently is, why does it have value? Like, why, you know, this is crazy. Why does this thing have any value at all? I don't understand. It's not backed by any government. Getting over that first hump is the most difficult thing, I think.
Yeah, I think you're probably right about that. So curious, what has been your success orange pilling friends and family?
You know, I'd say it's pretty good. I have like a number of family members cousins, I don't know why it's cousins, my sibling, my sister is not a Bitcoiner, but I have quite a few cousins who've gotten interested in and put like a pretty good chunk of savings in Bitcoin and fairly early on as well, like around 2017. And they're very happy with how it's done and have become over time real Bitcoiners too, have really been orange pilled and have become really good holders, have held, haven't sold any of their Bitcoin. Mm. So I'm pretty proud of that. And, you know, the book has done way better than I ever would have imagined. So I think one thing I've always felt pretty satisfied about is I've never had anyone come to me and present like a rebuttal of my book. And I kind of wished that someone had, because then I could engage with them and we could talk about the arguments. But I've never had someone say, hey, this argument in your book is completely wrong. It doesn't make any sense. And I think I don't want to flatter myself too much, but I think the reason that is because I start from very basic first principles. And I explain things in a way that I think is completely obvious and makes sense. And when you connect the dots, it's like, oh, yeah, now I get it. Now I understand why Bitcoin has money. There's no glaring assumption that I make that's like, oh, that's a crazy assumption. So, yeah, I feel pretty happy and proud that the book has done a job orange-pilling some people around the world. And it always feels really good to hear that people have read the book and say, yeah, you know, this is what got me into Bitcoin. Always makes me feel good.
I think I have a feeling there are three or four, five books in Bitcoin. Yours is one of them that 20, 50, 100 years from now, people are going to be pointing back to like these, wow, like how prophetic some of this was. And, you know, so I think you, Safe with the Bitcoin Standard, I think Price of Tomorrow. I wouldn't be surprised if like if Broken Money, even something big, like a big thesis like that effectively, they all so much of the brokenness plays out, and it's like, oh, like, yeah, someone knew, you know, back in the day, like, remember the, you know, the 2020s when this nascent technology was taking shape. So I think you're probably right. I want to talk to you about hyper Bitcoinization. So first of all, Well, actually, let me tell you sort of a paraphrase quote I heard on a podcast recently. Jim Kreider, he's a wealth advisor, Bitcoiner. He was on the Investors Podcast with Preston Pitch, and he effectively said, you know, all people are trying to compare Bitcoin to gold or the NASDAQ or something like that, but what the reality is that Bitcoin is the thing. Like this, it's what other assets are going to be measured in ultimately. Like it's the yardstick, it's the ruler. And I'm curious if that is that how you think of it? And if so, is that sort of how you define hyper Bitcoinization? Or how do you think about this concept that, you know, we Bitcoiners refer to as hyper Bitcoinization?
Yeah, so the term itself came from an article written by Daniel Krawitz. I hope I pronounced that correctly. And it was trying to take the idea of hyperinflation. And hyperinflation is this process where money completely loses value because it's being inflated too quickly and then people lose faith in it. And when they lose faith in it, they don't want to hold it anymore. And there are many countries in historically and in the present which have gone through hyperinflations. I have a story actually about a friend of mine who grew up in Argentina. And it's an amazing story. He told me that when you go to the grocery store when he was a kid, there was someone who would put prices on goods. And as soon as they went through the store and put all the prices on, they would start at the beginning and do it again. And the price would go up. Like within like multiple times a day, they would be increasing prices because the value of money was decreasing so quickly. So that's what a hyperinflation looks like when a currency is collapsing and people are just trying to get rid of their money. As soon as you get any money, you go and spend it because it's losing its value that quickly. Hyper-Bitcoinization was the idea of Bitcoin sort of forcing this, forcing people to jump out of their money because they see for a positive reason that Bitcoin is a better money and they jump out of the dollars and they jump into Bitcoin. And then the dollar loses its value just because, not because necessarily the policy is terrible, but because there's a much better alternative. So I think the ultimate result of hyper-Bitcoinization is that Bitcoin becomes that last point in the evolution of money, which is a unit of account. I think the global unit of account, where you go to the grocery store and you buy bread and it's measured in not in dollars, but it's measured in Satoshis. So that's what I think the end result of hyper Bitcoinization is. And it's also kind of a mindset, like using Bitcoin as your yardstick or the unit of account. A lot of people already do that. A lot of Bitcoiners do that. I like to think of the value of my assets in Bitcoin terms. And when you've made that mental switch and you're not measuring in dollars anymore, you realize that, wow, all these other investments kind of suck. Like the S&P over time compared to using the yardstick of dollars looks great, but using the yardstick of Bitcoin looks terrible. Like it's an asset which is continuously going down. Or you buy a house or you buy a car. And I think mentally this happens for a lot of people and it causes a personal transformation. Once you've made Bitcoin your unit of account, people become much bigger savers. They become much more fiscally responsible in their household and they start planning for the future more. They start thinking, what is a way that I can accumulate more Bitcoin? I believe it's going to become the unit of account. I think of it as my unit of account. How do I get more? And I've seen the thing I find so cool about Bitcoin adoption is I think it results in personal transformations for a lot of people.
Yeah, completely agree. I can speak for myself and say that is very much true. I've changed a lot of diet, sun intake, all sorts of things that you would never.
I think you're also a fan of Stephen Lubka.
Oh yeah, love Stephen.
The sun maximalist. Oh, man. Walking maximalist as well.
I need to get better about the walking, but yeah, my kids. I mean, I have a five and a 3 year old that like will joke about me always having my shirt off when we're outside or anything. Like it's bad. Okay, so. Safe to say you're still bullish on Bitcoin. the thesis hasn't changed.
Very, very fair to say. Yep.
So what predictions, anticipation of new developments do you have for Bitcoin over the next 18 months? If you want to share a price prediction, you're more than welcome to. People love that sort of thing. But nation state adoption, anything else?
I'm always hesitant to give price predictions. I think it's very dangerous because we really truly don't know the future and we don't know how things play out. I do think that the approval of the ETFs is profoundly important and will have a big impact on the amount of savings coming into Bitcoin. And the reason I say that is the hurdle to own Bitcoin directly is actually a big hurdle. Yeah, understanding wallets and addresses and how they work and signing up for a service like, you know, Coinbase and going through KYC AML and having all these limits before you can buy in size, that's all a real pain in the butt. Yeah. A huge pain in the butt. And most people who are investors have this sunk cost already, have gone through KYC AML with their brokerage service. It is so much easier to buy the ETF. So much easier. So I think this is going to make it This is going to make Bitcoin reachable for a lot more people in this cycle. I think the adoption is going to grow much more than it did in the prior cycle because of that.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of where Bitcoin will go, I feel like this cycle Bitcoin's going to take a big chunk out of gold. I don't mean necessarily that it's going to take market cap away from gold, but Bitcoin's size will achieve a significant fraction of gold. And then Bitcoin is really truly a macro asset, a global macro asset that will start behaving more like gold and less like kind of this volatile penny stock that people have sort of thought about it as, like, oh, wow, Bitcoin's super volatile. It moves all over the place. I think it'll become much more mature at the end of this cycle.
Yeah, I think that's probably a fair bet. I think it's for the first time people who have historically just sort of mocked Bitcoin because that was what everyone else was doing in their community now have it as a potential offering to people who don't want to take the time to learn about it or don't, you know, can't self-custody institutional, you know, adoption, that sort of thing. So I'm anxious to see over the next 18, 24 months what that looks like, but I can only imagine it's going to be a wild ride.
It's going to be fun. I tell people to enjoy this. If you're a Bitcoiner and this is your first cycle or you've been around one or two cycles, really enjoy the bull markets because you know this, Michael, the bear markets are so painful. Everyone tells you you're an idiot. There's this interest in Bitcoin in the general public basically disappears. They are painful. And sometimes, you know, if you haven't been through one before, it feels like they're not going to end. So when the sun comes out, when it's summertime again, in Bitcoin land, you should really take your shirt off and enjoy it.
I love it. Can't think of a better place to end than that. Vijay, thank you. Hey, you want to give a send off, anywhere to find you online? Obviously I told you I've got the book right here, Bullish Case for Bitcoin. Check it out. What else you got?
Yeah, so you can actually find, I think it might be sold out on Amazon. It's out of print now, but you can buy it from my website, bullishcaseforbitcoin.com. And you can find me on Twitter. I'm real_Vijay, so REAL_VIJAY. And I talk about Bitcoin a lot there. So if you're interested in Bitcoin and hearing what my thoughts are, find me on Twitter.
Terrific. And I'd encourage people to pay the premium and get the hard copy. That's my go-to. So definitely love the book. Vijay, thank you so much for your time, man. Can't thank you enough. Look forward to, hey, are you going to be in Prague or Nashville anywhere? I'm looking to get to some
of those.
I really
hope I can come to Nashville and get some sun with you.
Okay, perfect. Let's meet and catch up there.
That would be awesome. Right.
Take care, Vijay.
Thanks, Michael.
And that's a wrap. I hope you enjoyed this conversation. Vijay is an awesome guy, wealth of knowledge. I would highly encourage you to pick up his book, The Bullish Case for Bitcoin, especially for newer Bitcoiners, or if you've got folks, friends, family, whoever in your life that you want to share Bitcoin with. It's such a good primer and really does do a great job of starting at the beginning and explaining sort of why we need this before it gets into anything specific to Bitcoin. Give him a follow online. Again, really, really fantastic guy to keep up with. If you enjoyed this conversation, you're liking the podcast, the videos, give us a like, subscribe, share it with someone. Would really appreciate anything you could do to spread the word. Of course, if you need help with self-custody, check out the Bitcoin Way. We're on Twitter, X at the Bitcoin Way _, and you can find us at www.thebitcoinway.com. If you want to follow me, send me a message, share your thoughts. I'm on X as well, at the other M Jordan, and I've got a personal weekly Substack. It's blackhatbitcoin.substack.com. Would appreciate you checking it out. It's sort of Bitcoin basics as well, something you can share with friends and family who you're trying to get on board. Until next time, this is Michael Jordan signing off.